Doom do 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 do. Hi, plant people. Welcome to episode 53 of
Bloom and Grow Radio.
Hello, my plant friends. I hope you're well. By the time this episode airs, I will be on the West Coast already. Oh man, I'm so excited to meet so many of you. As I announced last week, we have an upcoming live taping and botanical and booze event at Folia Collective on March 18th. Check the show notes for the link if you want to come hang with us and have a little planty party in Los Angeles. And stay tuned to this podcast and on my Instagram for events, upcoming events in other cities, hopefully near you soon. I am also so excited. We're putting final touches on the Bloom and Grow merch. It is so freaking adorable. I can't even stand it. I'm so thankful to my listener and helper, Maria, for designing this incredible line of stuff. So stay tuned for that. Enough about the future. Today, I have Michael Mittermeier as my amazingly planty guest for the show. You'll learn why he's called Mick in the conversation, but he caught my eye on social media a while ago because of his incredible travel itinerary that this guy has and his obvious passion for finding plants that we know and love as houseplants, but in their natural habitats around the world. That's why I love that this episode's called Plants IRL, aka nature, because plants IRL, in real life, they live in nature. We just put them in pots because we love them so much. So Mick is a passionate plant professional who has traveled the world and documents his findings of rare and unusual plants on his Instagram account, Mick Mitty. And he also has one of the largest private collections of Monstera, Syngonium, Syndapsis, and Raphidophora, pronounce it correctly, Maria, Raphidophora, in the country. So I invited Mick on the show today to discuss his experience with our favorite houseplants in nature, aka IRL, but the conversation really kind of blossomed into a fun chat about a lot of topics, about how he plans his trips for plant sightseeing, how to take your plant obsession to the next level, how to engage with our plant community, how to learn from people about plants, and the original topic, what these plants are like in nature. And also, we talk a lot about Monstera. Get excited. Monstera in pots, Monstera in the wild, and Mick even teaches us a thing or two about the famous Adansonii versus obliqua debate, so get excited. I hope this conversation encourages you to learn more about where these plants we love to keep indoors actually come from, and I hope the conversation inspires you to maybe bring a new type of plant home or learn about a new type of plant from a new plant friend you make. Before we dive into our chat all about the plants that Mick loves to find outdoors, I wanted to tell you about today's sponsor who has helped me love my indoor collection of plants even more, Wally Grow. So you all know that I'm loving the ombre green wall that I've installed with Wally Grow Eco Planters in my living room, and I'm so excited to hear that many of you have purchased your own planters already. So this ad is my tips for you for your own installations. So tip number one, if you have any questions about the actual installation process, I would say go over to my Instagram account at Bloom and Grow Radio and watch the pinned stories. Our entire installation is featured in that. And if you have further questions, you can just DM me or send me an email via my website. The installation is as simple as putting one screw in the wall and then hanging the planter on the wall. And everything that you need for the installation comes with your purchase in the package. Tip number two that I kind of learned the hard way would be don't overcrowd the planters. So when I was planting them up, I got a little overzealous and I put 3 4-inch containers of philodendron in each of the Wally Grow Ecos, which fit, but you should really only plant 2 4-inch containers max in each eco so the plants have space to grow into the containers. So I ended up taking plants out of the ecos after I had potted them and it was messy and silly of me because I should have just done too. So you can either plant your plants directly in the planters like I did, or you can pot up your plants in separate pots with drainage and then put those pots, 4-inch max, in the eco containers. I know some of my friends do this method because they prefer to top water their plants in a normal planter with drainage, or if they want to switch out the variety of the plants in the eco containers on their walls depending on the season or the growth period or what available light that they have. And then the last big tip I have for you guys is for watering. So if you plant the ecos up the way that I did, They suggest the first time you pot the planters up with your plants, top water the planters in your sink. This is going to help the roots and the soil settle the way we give any plants that we initially pot up a good watering to help everything settle. But do it in the sink before you hang your planters. Then, after you've hung your planters, only water the plants through that water reservoir that you see. This way, the pots are leak-proof and your walls stay intact. So if you're interested in learning the indoor and outdoor options that Wally Grow has for your home, visit wallygrow.com and use code BLOOM20, BLOOM20 at checkout for 20% off your order. And let me know what you're planning on doing with your eco planters. I love hearing everybody's ideas. You're all so creative and individual. It's so fun. Okay, plant friends, here's Mick. Do you have upcoming travel to a different country scheduled, or maybe you have a relative or a friend who speaks a different language that you want to connect with on a deeper level? Why not easily learn a new language with my favorite language learning tool, Rosetta Stone? I recently went to Italy and I brushed up on my Italian by using the Rosetta Stone app for like 20 minutes every morning. It was so easy to use. It was part of my morning practice. It was really fun. And let me tell you, Rosetta Stone works. It brushed me up so good. I was getting around Italy easily speaking Italian after putting those reps in. If you don't already know, Rosetta Stone is the trusted language learning tool available on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone has 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered. It makes language learning so fun, so easy, and so fast. It immerses you in the language, which is the fastest way to learn. So it's an intuitive process with no English translation, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in the language. It even coaches you on pronunciation with its true accent feature, which is like basically having a physical trainer for your accent. It's so wild. The desktop and app options make it so easy to do consistently, and it's an amazing value. Lifetime membership has all 25 languages forever for any and all trips and language needs in your entire life. So this year I brushed up on my Italian, but next year Billy and I want to go to Japan so we could learn conversational Japanese with it. That's lifetime access to 25 language courses Rosetta Stone has to offer, and right now they're offering 50% off. It's an insane steal. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Growing Joy with Plants listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life, plant friends. It's an insane deal. Redeem 50% off at Rosetta, R-O-S-E-T-T-A, stone.com/today. Mick, thanks for coming on Bloom and Grow Radio today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you and talk about all of the incredible planty adventures that you have. First off, you're Michael, you're Mick. What do you go by?
Yeah, so I actually go by Mick, and that's actually a pretty recent development within the last, I'd say like 5 to 6 years. The reason being, when I was a kid, I would always go by Mickey, you know, I guess, which is just kind of a shortened version of Michael. I was actually at a conservation event once with my parents, because both of my parents are really influential in conservation circles. And I was at this one event in Los Angeles, and I was there with Harrison Ford, who is the actor who plays Han Solo, Indiana Jones. And he is the, for the last 25 years, he's been on the board of directors of Conservation International, the company that my dad was the president of for 30 years. So I've known Harrison ever since I was a little kid. But on this one occasion at this event, I remember I was in an elevator. I was just going to my room, and Harrison comes up behind me. And there we were, just together, the two of us. I must have been 13 at the time.
Oh my gosh.
He turns to me and goes, "How you doing, Mickey?" And then I go, "Oh, good, good, sir, good." And then he pauses for a second. He looks at me and goes, "Mickey, you know, you're getting kind of old. That's kind of a sissy name. You should change it to something tougher like Mick, you know, Mick Dundee, Mick Jagger." And I was like, "Oh my God, Indiana Jones told me I had to change my name."
If Indiana Jones tells you to change your name, you change your name.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So I was like, I guess it's Mick now, I guess.
Oh my God, I love that. That's so funny. And obviously you're known as Mick Mitty on Instagram. You have the plantiest Instagram feed. And the coolest thing I think about you is that you aren't a houseplant person particularly. You see plants IRL, like in nature. You're kind of the expert, or you travel a lot finding these plants that we keep in our air-conditioned and heated apartments where they originate in nature in Costa Rica and Colombia and like all these amazing places.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I can't talk down entirely to houseplant people because it is a way that a lot of collectors get their start, right? And it's the way that I got my start. It must have been like 5 or 6 years ago now. I was just finishing school and I'd always liked decorating my apartment with pothos and, you know, philodendron and heteraceum and, you know, common things like that. But I can actually remember I was on Google or something and I remember seeing a Tillandsia, you know, like a houseplant or like an air plant. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking like, wow, that is really, really cool. Like in all my trips, I've never seen anything that looks quite like that. That's a really unique organism. And so I went and I bought like 5 or 6 of them on, you know, eBay. And I was like, awesome, you know, and I brought them home and I thought they were so neat. And I you know, looked at how other people did it on Pinterest and stuff, like hanging them on the walls. And so that's what I did. And I kind of started going a little nuts. And I remember at one point I probably had about 50 or 60 of them. And I had an entire wall of my apartment just completely covered in them. And then I went on a week long vacation. And I came back and every single one of them had died.
And only a week long?
Only a week long and every single one of them died. And I was so devastated and I was so angry. And this is actually kind of a trend that's carried on for the rest of my collecting is that when I kill something, it becomes like a personal vendetta. It becomes like a mission that I have to eventually get it right and figure out, you know, how to grow it. And so after I did that, I did just a ton of research on, you know, why that would have happened. And what I found out is that air plants and the whole industry that kind of sells air plants is really terrible for the air plant because you're talking about an aerial species that, you know, the air plant thing is correct, you know, because this is not it's not one of the tank type bromeliads like an Echmea or Neorigelia. These plants don't collect water in the center. They have trichomes all along their leaves, which is kind of like what the fuzziness is. And those little trichomes are basically mouths that collect floating detritus and floating debris and that they open up to absorb water. And the one critical thing that air plants need that no one takes into account is airflow.
Yeah.
They need
airflow. Circulation.
And almost all of them need full sun. So, you know, that's, I think, what killed mine is that I was watering them for too long and they weren't drying quickly enough and all this stuff. And so I moved my entire collection outside and I quickly tripled it since then. And that was kind of like my entryway into learning about plants, not just keeping plants, because that's a critical piece of the equation, you know?
Absolutely. We did an Air Plant 101 episode a while back in season 2, but I said this on that episode and I'll say it again. The thing with air plants, because you see them on Pinterest, you see them in like cute little nooks and crannies, and I have a lovely collection. That. Yeah. And I actually have 4 pregnant air plants right now. My indoor air plants are doing great, but I'll always remember I was visiting my grandparents in West Palm Beach and I looked up at the trees and the trees were filled with air plants.
Oh, Tillandsia utriculata and fasciculata, yeah.
Yeah, it was, but for me as the like, oh, I saw them on Pinterest, I bought them in a plant shop, I brought it back to my house and I live in New York City. I had never seen an air plant in real life. And then I remember just like the first time seeing them in a tree, like the way that they were intended to. And it kind of shifted the way I looked at them because I was like, oh, right. Like they like to be hanging, you know, on the mesh kind of air plant holders or that kind of stuff because they're literally doing this in nature.
They like to be tortured in nature. It's amazing. Yeah. You see them in situ in some places. You're talking about like desert habitats where it's scorching hot, full sun, totally dry. And that plant
is just chilling.
There,
yeah.
Living its best life. It's really, really weird.
You know? It's so interesting. But that's why I'm so excited to talk to you because I feel like with houseplant parents, a lot of us don't get the opportunity to have that experience, especially if you live in the Northeast like I do. Before we dive into more of your travels and more of the plants you've seen, how did you get the bug for traveling? Like, how have you grown up with this incredible passion and kind of how have you developed into this passionate plant person that you are now?
So the travel aspect of it is always something that kind of takes people for a loop. They always, you know, especially the plant people, because, you know, I'm known for my collection. I'm not really known for my traveling and for even what my family's work is. You know, people know me for the stuff I do. And then later on, they find out the family that I come from and they're like, oh my God, wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so the household I was raised in was one of nature, nature, nature. You know, I was raised by two incredibly passionate conservationists. My dad, like I mentioned, he was the president of Conservation International for 28 years. Conservation International is this huge multinational organization. I think at its peak, it was based in something like 40 different countries, you know, working on doing things like creating hotspots areas, areas of high biodiversity and endemism, working with indigenous communities and different, you know, indigenous groups around the world to kind of protect, you know, nature in those places, and just working to protect endangered species. So, I mean, it was a really interesting kind of thing to grow up with that influence. And then also my mother she was a mom up until I was about in fifth grade. And then she went to the Corcoran Institute in DC and studied photography. And then from there, she just went gung-ho with it. And she started traveling with my dad with a camera, photographing all kinds of stuff, photographing indigenous groups and animals and wildlife. And then she started selling. I remember she would sell prints at the local library. And then the next step above that for her was creating the ILCP, the International League of Conservation Photographers. She later left that organization to work with National Geographic. My parents split up a few years ago. And so now my mom has been with Paul Nicklin, who's a National Geographic photographer, you know, for the last, like, I can't even remember how long it's been, like 7-8 years, but they live together up in British Columbia. And I don't know if anyone here knows Paul. He is the preeminent underwater photographer for National Geographic. And he works.
Oh, that's so cool.
And he works in the Arctic and Antarctic predominantly. And so if you've seen that photograph of the leopard seal feeding somebody a penguin, you know that one?
Yeah.
That's his photo.
Oh my God. We'll link to it in the show notes if you could send it.
Better yet, the video of the polar bear dying. You must have seen that.
Yes.
They took that last year in Greenland.
Oh my God. And we'll have those in the show notes.
Yeah, that'd be great. And so mom, you know, and Paul, they work with National Geographic freelance, and then they've created a new organization called Sea Legacy, working to kind of preserve the natural heritage of the ocean. And it was just amazing growing up with them. And so
you got to tag along on all of their amazing work trips. Like, you just got to be part of the action. So no wonder you have such a passion for nature.
So from age one, I think my first trip was to like Mexico. Then right after that was Australia and Sulawesi. And now at age 26, I've been to 80 countries in all 7 continents.
Oh my gosh. Have most of your travels been associated with your parents and siblings? Because one of our listeners wrote in asking how you coordinate these incredible plant trips you go on. So do you have any advice about that?
Yeah. So I get asked this all the time. People always are really interested to find out kind of like what the secret is of travel.
Yeah.
And the reality is there's no secret. It's all about being clever and I think, and taking opportunities as they come to you, right? You never know when the chance for travel is going to come up. And, you know, I've had friends get opportunities for trips and say things like, oh, I can't go because of, you know, my pets or whatever, or like my work. And, you know, it's just a matter of saying, you know, of prioritizing travel above everything else, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people tell me, oh, it's too expensive. And I mean, come on, if you book a ticket, you know, 6 months in advance, it's only going to be a couple hundred bucks. You know, you just have to be really smart about it's also about where you want to go, how you want to go, and what you want to see, I think, is what's really important, right? Because if you're willing to just like really scrounge and camp and stuff and like, you know, really kind of rough it, then it'll be a lot cheaper than if you're trying to stay at like the Hilton, you know? It all depends on what kind of travel you want to do. But for my part, at least, the travel has been, and the plant stuff has been kind of a side venture, right? Because when I travel with my family, when I do, it's usually for a completely different mission. You know, they'll be wanting to see their own things or do their own work. And then my plant stuff will be on the side.
Got it. Right. That's kind of amazing. Another travel tip, I feel like, because I'm on a tour right now of a musical, and Bloomin'Gur season 3 is actually on the road around the country.
Oh, wow.
A travel tip that I would give that I'm like really leaning into with this tour is credit card points.
Yeah.
Like, I haven't paid for a flight. I mean, we take all sorts of vacations because we like play that credit card point game in a healthy financial way. I mean, I pay all my credit cards off, but you know, I just got like a Delta credit card and I hit the bonus and I have 100,000 points in my account. So
Delta,
there's like
free stuff.
Yeah, Delta, not hashtag not sponsored.
Yeah, right.
But so if you do want to take a planty trip, you can kind of get savvy with finding the credit cards and getting, you know, becoming a hotel, you know, membership, get a Marriott rewards card or at least a number. So wherever you stay, you can like accrue points. That really helps. Billy and I have taken a lot of trips that way for free using hotel points. And I mean, we haven't traveled as extensively as you have, but we've definitely cashed in hotel points and flight points.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's amazing. I mean, yeah, doing just smart things like that, and then also, and also just the fact that people seem to overestimate how much they think travel actually costs. I mean, it depends on where you're going. I mean, obviously, if you're going to like Prague, it's going to cost a lot more if you're going to like Cambodia. But I'm thinking that, you know, a few years ago in 2014, my girlfriend and I took a backpacking trip across, I think it was like six countries in Southeast Asia, and the entire thing only cost us about $1,000 because it was so cheap. I mean, everything in that part of the world is so cheap.
Once you get over there, yeah.
Once you get over there, yeah.
Just getting there, yeah.
We were there for 3 months, and it was just like, you know, stuff costs nothing, which is amazing. And so, you know, that's just another thing to consider when you're traveling somewhere, is just that, you know, not everywhere is going to be as expensive as you know,
as you, yeah, as the States, yeah. So, in your travels, do you want to give me maybe like your top three? It could be more or less. Maybe destinations and the plants, like your favorite plants that you've seen. So like, where was the best Monstera that you saw? And like, tell us about what experiencing it in real life. And I know you have like a huge Raphidophora collection. So like, could you maybe tell us, take some popular house plants and tell us your experience seeing them in nature and what that was like for you?
Yeah, sure. Of course. The problem with me and my traveling is that for the last 80 countries that I've done, it wasn't until the last few years that I started kind of focusing very heavily on plant stuff. The majority of them were looking for other things, right? Looking for monkeys because my dad's a primatologist, or looking for birds because my brother's an ornithologist. So I can talk about the last, I think, like two or three trips that I've done in the last couple of years that were, you know, really exclusively for plants, which I think was a really kind of special thing for me to do. And so I think the top three would probably be, yeah, Colombia, which I did at the end of 2017, and then Suriname, which I did at the beginning of this year, and then Costa Rica, which I did at the end of this last year. And all three of those countries are just, well, Suriname's not really an aroid hotspot, but Colombia and Costa Rica are fantastic. And Colombia especially is, I think, probably the global hotspots for aroids. I mean, I was talking to Tom Crow earlier this year when I was at Missouri Botanical Garden, and I think he told me a statistic. He said that Colombia has got something close to like 3,000 unidentified species. He's also said that Colombia has more species of aroids than the rest of the world combined, or something like that. I mean, just something unbelievable. Just areas like the Choco and stuff like that, where the diversity of plants is just out of this world.
So aroids in Colombia, what would you say are like the biggest differences between seeing them like climbing on the tree versus like climbing a moss pole, or like some, you know, or not even climbing anything in like in a pot?
The difference between seeing a houseplant and a plant in the wild is that you really need to focus on wild plants because they are everywhere. It is amazing. It is crazy to see plants in situ. It's not so much that you're actually looking for a plant. It's more like, if you get lucky, you'll see it, because especially somewhere like Colombia, you know, you will go to a place where there'll be a muddy hill, and every square inch of it is covered with plants, and covered with aroids, covered with ferns, covered with bromeliads. And you just like, you'd have to spend like a week in one site just to kind of get a good grasp on what's there, just because it's so lush and so full of stuff, and it's crazy. And the really hilarious thing is that people kind of, they breeze right by it. You know, no one really understands, you know, what is there. I mean, I had a friend who, I think it was actually Enid, who told me the story of when she was in Costa Rica and she saw, and you know, by the side of the road, a beautiful philodendron varicosum, which is a common houseplant. And she said that she went down for a walk. She came back 20 minutes later, and someone with a weed whacker was there clearing the area and had chopped the varicosum up into a million little pieces. And
so, oh my God.
Yeah, I know. So it's just like weeds to the people who live there, which is so funny. So when I was in Colombia, one of the plants that I was really keen on finding there was Monstera xanthospatha.
Okay. And what's that? Can you describe that a little bit for listeners who might not know, aka me?
Xanthospatha, which means yellow flower, yellow in fluorescence, it does have that. And I'll send you a photo later. It's just a beautiful, like the spadix is completely yellow, and it's just a really kind of bright yellow. It's really pretty. But Xanthospatha is a little known species because it's endemic only to the Andes. So I think it's the Western Cordillera of Colombia is one of the only places that it's found.
How do you spell it? I'm Googling it right now, and I can't even, it's not even coming up on Google.
Xanthospatha, it's Xanthospath,
Xanthospatha. And it's Monstera?
Yeah, Monstera. And it's a really beautiful species. You're probably not going to find many pictures of it unless they're from my Instagram?
It's coming up. It's so funny. I'm searching it on Google Images and nothing's coming up.
That's the
story. Oh, there it is. Now I found a little bit of it.
That's the story with so many Monsteras. And that's part of the reason why Monsteras really caught my attention to begin with, was because they're so mysterious, you know? No one knows anything about them. And if people are claiming that they know something about them, unless they have multiple degrees, I'm just going to assume that it's made up, because so few people actually study the group. I think I only have maybe two friends that specialize in the group, you know, and actually are working on reassessing the genus. But it's a passion of mine. I love Monstera. And so every time I go somewhere, I'm looking for them. But I can remember when I was trying to find Xanthospatha in Colombia, you know, I was just, I was there for an aeroid conference, because every year you have the International Aeroid Society meeting in Miami. But then I think it's like every 2 years or every three or something. It's not annual though, but every couple of years you have an aeroid conference, which takes place in like usually a different country. So I think this last one was in Cali, Colombia, and then the next one's going to be in Berlin or something. But it's just a meeting where all the aeroid researchers actually get together, and you know, they have some field time, and they just give a lot of talks. And so that's what I went to Cali for. I went for that meeting just because I wanted to rub shoulders with all the great aeroid researchers and try to pretend like I was one of them.
So cool.
I went there with my good friend Greg Ward, who has been a member of the Aeroid Society for a long, long time, and he actually lives right next to Mobot, and he's volunteered there and worked there in the past. You know, he contacted me and he said, you know, we'd only met one time at the IAS show in Miami, and he called me and said, "Mick, you want to come with me to Colombia?" And I said, "Hell yeah!" And so we went early, and I used a contact of mine from Conservation International, a friend of mine, Leonardo Saenz. And with him, we went to all these different national parks, like the Farallones de Cali National Park in the mountains. And we were walking around at altitude and climbing these mountains looking for aeroid species. And we found just like some unbelievable plants. And then afterwards, we went to the conference, and then we went on another little side trip. And then that was where I found Xanthospatha. And it's similar in a lot of ways to Monstera obliqua. You know, it's got...
That's on my list of questions for you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I can talk forever about obliqua. I love it. But Xanthospatha and obliqua are similar because they both have the really, really holy leaves, you know? Like, not a lot of clones of obliqua have really heavily perforated leaves, but the ones that do are really quite stunning. And Xanthospatha looks like that, because Xanthospatha has a small leaf, and then it has really big holes for some reason, like really big divisions, and they're just really bizarre looking. And when I was walking around in the forest and I saw it for the first time, I was just like a kid in a candy shop. I couldn't stop smiling. I was jumping up and down. I mean, you can ask Morgan from Planting Pink. She was actually there with me when I saw it, and I was just like a little giddy schoolgirl. I was like, "Oh my God, Xanthospatha!"
I love that. One of my questions, because I know that you participate in this debate a lot, is Monstera adansonii versus obliqua. Two questions. Number one, like, what's your key for differentiating the two of them? And also, another listener question, which is something that I've thought about too. What's your opinion? I mean, do you know some of these Monsteras, like the obliqua, which feels like there's more fenestration than there is actual leaf. The fenestrations are so large. These plants look so delicate, and they look like lace. Like, they look like if you touch them, they could almost break. But they're designed to live in these like crazy kind of brutal conditions outside with crazy rainfall. And like, I don't know, if they're in the understory, maybe animals climbing on them. Like, why did they evolve like that?
That's actually a really interesting question. And I can actually remember when I was at the Columbia meeting, I sat down with an aeroid researcher from Southeast Asia named Peter Boyce. And I asked him that same question. And Peter is the genius of species like, you know, Homalamina and Bucephalandra and Raphidophora and Syndaspis and things like that. And so I asked him, I was like, Peter, it's so weird. You know, you've got neotropical and paleotropical species like Raphidophora and Epiprenum and Monstera all have perforations. You know, what is the reason? I want to know. And he was like, he's British. He was like, "Well, Mick, there's no answer." And so he told me that, you know, nobody's ever done their dissertation on this. I don't think anyone's ever done, you know, heavy research onto why. But there are a bunch of working theories. You know, a lot of people think that because Monsteras have such massive leaves that the, you know, leaves towards the canopy are blocking out sun and rain from reaching the understory leaves. So they think that maybe the holes are to allow water and sunlight to access the younger leaves. But that theory doesn't really make a lot of sense. I mean, some people think that it's a defense mechanism against insect predation. They think that if you've got a plant with a lot of holes in it, then it'll look damaged and diseased, and so insects won't want to bite it, right? But I think that perhaps the most likely explanation for why is planned cell senescence. And so so when you think about groups like Monstera, it has some of the largest leaves of any aroid, you know, of any climbing aroid. They get leaves that are just humongous. I mean, I was just in Costa Rica and I saw Monstera tenui at La Selva, which is credited with having, I think, the longest leaf of any Monstera. And they're just huge leaves. They get like, you know, 4 or 5 feet long. They're really enormous. And it costs a lot of energy to have leaf, you know, in all of that. So there's an article out there, which I read years ago. It's about planned cell senescence, which is the, you know, the plant actually deciding that they're going to remove parts of the leaf to kind of save energy. Pretty good concept, right? You know, you think about it, you're like, I want a really big leaf for a lot of surface area for photosynthesis, but I don't want to waste all the energy in making it a whole leaf. So I'll put a bunch of holes in it, right?
Yeah, man, that's efficient.
And then there's also ideas about wind resistance, you know, like, oh, if the breeze blows, then the leaf's not going to get ripped up if it has holes. But, you know, I mean,
right. Or the rain to kind of like trickle through it instead of like beat the leaf up as it hits like the entire leaf.
Exactly. So there's a bunch of theories, but there's no one answer. And I think it changes, you know, in different countries and different environments, you know, for different species for sure, because no one Monstera has the same pattern of perforation as another. So, right. You know, there's got to be multiple explanations, I think.
Okay. So settle the big debate. Adansonii versus obliqua. Tell us. How do you differentiate?
How do you differentiate?
And what makes them so different?
What makes them so different, I think first and foremost, is aside from the fact that one is 100 million times more available than the other.
Yes. The biggest Adansonii is the more available one.
Yeah. The biggest difference is that obliqua is a miniature species. And if you look at the features, because this is the thing I always get, you know, people will say, oh, is this an obliqua? Is this an obliqua? You know, when they're posting on Instagram and Facebook, and they're always sending me a picture of a leaf, and it's always an immature leaf, and it's always a plant with no inflorescence, with no features. You know, if you show somebody an immature leaf of a Monstera, it's about as useful for identification as sending someone a picture of a tree while you're driving 80 miles down the highway. I mean, there's no point, because what you need is you need a mature plant and you need a flower in order to identify something correctly. But the key feature that I've used in identifying stuff in, you know, I mean, there's features that you can use to identify obliqua versus Adansonii. I mean, one of them is the fact that the obliqua inflorescence is this tiny little stout thing, you know, in some places across its range, it'll be yellow in coloration. In some clones, it actually smells like banana, I've heard, but I've never seen it myself in person. Other things with obliqua is that you've got things like a persistent sheath is one of the traits that it has. It's got a very few number of fruits on the actual inflorescence when it's creating the seeds. It's just a very physically different flower and physically different plant. The confusing thing about obliqua though, is that it has a massive range. So it occurs all over Amazonia, from the Western Amazon and, you know, Ecuador and Peru, all the way to the Guyanas, where I've seen it in the wild. You find it in Brazil. You can find it up into Costa Rica and Panama. I mean, it just occurs everywhere. And when Michael Madison did his revision of the Monsteras in 1977, I was actually also talking to Tom about this recently, and I didn't know this, but Tom Crowett told me that Madison did it as a dissertation project. He did it as like a PhD project, trying to revise the entire genus of Monstera. And Tom was like, wow, that's a really ambitious project. And that's probably why it was kind of like not done as well as it could have been, because it's just huge and it's so difficult to do. So what I think happened was that Madison lumped a bunch of different species. You know, you go around to these different countries and you find these different plants, or you look through herbarium sites, you find plants that kind of look similar. And so he did it with Monstera lechleriana, and he did it with things like obliqua, you know, because obliqua can be split into a bunch of different species, and it has been, you know. Monstera expilata from the Guyana, from French Guiana, looks like Monstera obliqua. Monstera calipii from Peru used to be another species that has since been lumped into obliqua. And so what researchers like Tom Crowett think is going to happen in the future is that obliqua, what we know as obliqua, which is this species that has this range across all of Amazonia, will be split up into its original different groups, into different species. So it's difficult for me to speak on obliqua as a whole.
You hear that slurping, plant friends? That is me on my dregs of my daily dose of greens, courtesy of today's sponsor, Equilibria. Equilibria is a woman-owned wellness brand with unique science-backed products that help bring your mind and body back into harmony. I always have loved green juice and greens powders. Obviously, I love plants. I love growing plants. I love eating plants. Plants are good for you. And I have tried most greens powders brands on the market, honestly, at this point. I have to say, I'm really loving the Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens. I might argue it's probably one of the best tasting greens powders I've ever had, and that says a lot because I've tried most of them. The Equilibria Daily Nutri-Greens contains an immune antioxidant and detox blend, along with prebiotics, probiotics, and over 35 fruits and veggies. There's no way I'm eating 35 fruits and vegetables throughout the day, but I love that I'm getting little doses and the micronutrients that are in each of the different veggies and fruits, right? Plus, they're certified organic, which I love. A lot of the competitors are not. I just mix one scoop of the greens powder into my water every day, and I'm shocked at how delicious this powder tastes. It's kind of like apple juice. I started back on the greens powder bandwagon because this spring, in this like season of rejuvenation, I'm kind of rejuvenating, doing an overhaul of my health. I've returned to my workout routine. I'm getting in more sleep. I've recommitted to my morning practice, and I've made this Equilibria Nutri-Greens part of that morning practice, drinking the powder in water in the morning. Plus, I love a female-founded company, right? Don't we all? If you want to try this greens powder, Equilibria is hooking you up with 15% off. Head to myeq.com and use code BLOOM for 15% off Equilibria's daily Nutri-Greens and so many other different products on their website. That's myeq.com and use code BLOOM at checkout for 15% off site-wide today. One thing I just want to reiterate, and this is something that I've been struggling with as my, like, you know, plant parent 101, 102, 201 level of knowledge, is a lot of the identifying factors of plants, like when we talked about with Enid on my Aroid 101 series, It's not the leaves, it's the flowers. But yeah, a lot of times, Monstera as a houseplant doesn't really bloom because it's not in like the super ideal circumstances. Like, you rarely see a Monstera bloom indoors. Yeah. So it's really hard. Like, your Monstera adansonii isn't probably going to bloom in your like mid to low light apartment. So you can't like differentiate the way you could when you're outside.
Absolutely. And that's actually one of the things that forced me to be an outdoor grower, actually, was when I was living in the apartment. After I did the whole air plant thing, I started collecting Monsteras, you know, because I got really into it. I visited a collector named Robert Chumley, and he gave me a Monstera deliciosa. And I saw his obliquas that he had, and I thought, wow, that's really cool. Like, I want those. And so he gave me a little tiny piece of one, which I grew up. And then I just started collecting like crazy. I remember I had species like Lechleriana and Adansonii and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And what I kind of very quickly realized was that without growing them outside and growing them up a tree, all you have is just ugly, like nondescript green leaf that doesn't do anything, right? And so that's—
Oh, see, I would argue that I love the Monstera leaves. I think they look so cool in apartments, but I agree with you that you don't get the entire experience of the plant, for sure.
Certain species like deliciosa, which is like made of leather, you know?
Right.
Like, deliciosa will always produce holes inside. Like, you know, it just grows so well. But when you start delving into anything slightly more complicated than deliciosa, you really have to put in the work to, for example, Siltapecana, you know, the little silvery one.
I don't, but maybe you can send us a photo so we can have it in the show notes.
Sure. I mean, that's another one of the really common Monsteras. It's got this beautiful kind of silver sheen kind of pattern on it. And to get it growing to maturity is really hard. I never managed to do it until I moved to Florida and I sent it up a moss pole. And and now I'm looking at it right now. It's in my, you know, I can see it from my kitchen, you know. And when it's mature, it actually looks a lot like an Adansonii. It's just got similar shaped leaves with just little midrib perforations. And it's just a really elegant plant. So that's what drove me to do it was, you know, so I would experiment with different ways. I tried doing the moss poles, which is like where you wrap sphagnum around the PVC. And that's like such a pain in the butt to do that because it's so time consuming. And so
I have a couple of moss poles in my apartment. I think your friend Tyler from your local Plant Boy, you guys know each other, right?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, he's come down here.
He came on my podcast and did a moss pole tutorial because he's like the moss pole god. Mm-hmm. And I only have three right now on my Monsteras and my Raphidophora tetrasperma. But it is funny because it's like the more moss poles you make, the more you're like, shoot, I really need like 10 more on the rest of my plants and keeping them hydrated. Like you do have to water them a lot. Enough.
So moss pole with sphagnum moss. Mm-hmm. You want to know the secret ingredient that works better than moss is
Yes, tell us.
I used to have moss poles too. Like I made a couple of them and the problem was I would put them on wood and the moss would stay dry and it wouldn't stay wet long enough and all this crap. And then and the wood rots out. The number one best secret for growing Monstera, and I've actually never tried this indoors, so some of you might actually have some luck with this, is go and buy like a 50-foot long roll of coconut coir.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And then what I do is I get a 10-foot long PVC pipe and I cut it into sections of like 5 feet or 3 feet or whatever. And then I will wrap the coir on with zip ties. And that is the hands down best way to grow Monsteras, because the Monsteras, I've seen it in every botanical garden I've been to. That is the way to do it. And now I've got every single one of my Monstera species growing up coir poles and they just love it. And it's the only surface I've ever seen them reliably root onto.
So you wrap the pole with coconut coir instead of sphagnum moss?
Yes, because the coir will hold the humidity.
It retains water much better than sphagnum. That's a very interesting idea, Mick. I got to try that.
Yeah, and it's a much better medium for the Monsteras to actually root into. And what's interesting is I've had some species, like I had a Standaliana, which was approaching reaching maturity on a moss pole. It was like a 6 foot moss pole, and a coir pole. And so he was going up, and then he the bottom rotted out for some reason because he was too wet. And I was like, crap, like the plant is toast, whatever. And I have left it outside for the last 6 months, and it is rooted onto the tip of the moss pole or the coir pole.
Oh.
And the roots are actually in the coir and it's extended back down into the dirt. So even though it's not actually connected to the soil, it's still managing to grow as an epiphyte, which I think is really cool.
Wait, that's amazing.
Yeah,
that's wacky.
And that's what they do in the wild too, which is really phenomenal. Like sometimes you'll see them, like I've seen Dubia 100 feet up a tree, and then you'll look at the base of the tree and there's no stem. It's all just roots that have extended down.
Right, like the original plant has died, like the roots have died out, and then the top of the plant has grown to replace. Oh, that's interesting.
Completely epiphytic, really weird. And you actually see that a lot with a lot of the Scandinanthuriums, like Clavigerum and Pentaphyllum. And it's just really cool. Just a really cool kind of.
Oh my God, you know all the names. You know all the fancy names. I'm so impressed.
That's Dad's fault. You know, he raised me to be a little taxonomically minded wacko.
Of course. I love that. So, Oh my God, I love that this has basically turned into a Monstera conversation. But I wanted to ask you, so you have the largest private collection, which is outdoors, of Monstera. And then you also said Syngonium, Syndapsis, and Raphidophora.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your opinion of Tetrasperma that's having like such a moment right now?
Well, I love it because I can just take cuttings of my Tetrasperma and, you know, I don't name prices, you know, because I look at a Tetrasperma like a weed. It just grows like crazy in my yard. And so I'll occasionally put them on eBay and I'll be like, I'll put them on Instagram story and I'll say, someone make me an offer. And people go nuts, man. They're like, I'll give you $50 for it. I'll give you $60. And I'm like, for this, for a cutting of this, I'm not even rooted. Like you guys are nuts, you know? So it's good. I mean, and Tetrasperma is such a nice plant. It's really attractive. You know, I think that of the Raphidophoras, Tetrasperma and Decorviza are obviously the most popular. And I think that, in Florida, they're kind of weedy. I had a friend who had a property with 14 acres, and I think every square inch of it had Decorviza on it. He had it growing up the side of his house and stuff. Like, it just takes over.
Now, Raphidophora, I really don't know much about the family except for Tetrasperma, because I come from the houseplant first world. Are they similar to Monstera, where a lot of them do have, like, irregularly shaped leaves?
The asymmetrical leaves. Yeah, they, Raphidophora, Epipranum, Syndaspis, all these paleotropical species are ancestrally related to Monstera. And they are, and so you can see it in the inflorescence, you can see it in the shape of the leaf and all these different features. And they are very closely related. And that's why they're some of the only old world species that have perforations, right? Because they're related. It's really interesting to kind of trace the history of these plants and how they've moved and all this stuff. And nobody's done enough work on it because
And there's so many different varieties. It's kind of like an unending hill to climb up.
It's always amazed me that Monstera gets so little attention, because currently, I think there's only between 40 and 60 known species, and Croat says that number is going to double in the near future, but, you know, that's not that many species to work with. Compared to Anthurium or Philodendron, where there's like hundreds of them, it's kind of crazy. You'd think that'd be the first one people would jump on.
Yeah, that's true. They're like the more palatable. Yeah. So when you are traveling and you see, like, how has your collection, having the largest collection, which also it's, you must have a very large yard that all these plants are growing, but do you ever take cuttings from your trips and bring them home? I would assume there are rules about that.
There's a lot of rules, and it's very complicated. And sometimes you run into situations where you'll take cuttings, you'll do your best to clean them, you'll do their best to prepare them, and then you bring them to the airport, and you'll take them through customs, and then you'll declare them and all this stuff, and then they'll find something that they don't like, and then they'll just torch the entire shipment. And it's really frustrating working within the lines. But yeah, I have on occasion brought stuff back, and it's interesting, and it's an interesting game of trying to kind of, you know, get the cuttings and grow them and root them and all this. And there are failures, you know, and those are very devastating. But yeah, it's just a shame, you know. And there's some countries like Colombia and Brazil that are just like completely closed off to anything. And it makes me very sad, you know, because I've spent a lot of time at different botanical gardens, and I've gone behind the scenes at quite a lot of, you know, several of the botanical gardens. And the same thing that they always tell me is that almost none of them do any wild collection anymore. And I find that so sad. And the reason being is just because logistically, it's so complicated to do it. And nobody wants to go through the trouble and the hassle of doing it. In some countries like Colombia, if you bring something back, then technically it belongs to Colombia still, and they can repatriate it at any time. And there's just a bunch of really, really ridiculous rules. And I think that it just doesn't do much to serve botanical knowledge at all. And some places like Missouri, for example, they've closed off any and old wild collection of any plants, you know, after 50 years of doing it. They've just said like no more. And that's so sad, you know, because you collect something for a herbarium where you just have a dry specimen, and that's one thing. But if you don't have a living plant to see how it grows and how it flowers, right, for potential reintroduction, you know, it's just like, what's the point, you know?
And to make more of them. Do you have any suggestions for people who might want to kind of take their plant collections to the next level? And maybe, you know, they only have a Monstera Borsigiana and a Monstera Deliciosa, but they want to expand, or like they want to start getting into the kind of nerdier next level plants. Like, how have you grown your collection? What have you found that works, and what suggestions might you have for people?
You got to go nuts with it. I mean, you just, I think the big thing with me was an aspect of guilt, you know, because when you think of houseplants and when you think of plants in general, you know, at least for me, two things pop to mind. It's like my grandma owns plants. And then there's like the concept of like the nerdy botanist who just kind of like sits around. I think that those are stigmas that people should just throw out the window. I've heard so many collectors and so many friends, like they talk about the guilt, right? The guilt of keeping plants, the guilt of kind of pursuing this career. And people just need to kind of realize that that's a ridiculous mentality, and that if you love it, then you should do it just 100%. Just go hard and just don't care about what anyone else says, you know, because my family too, you know, I started out doing reptiles, and that when I moved to plants, everyone was like, what are you doing? Like, are you going through some kind of crisis? Like, why are you on grandma mode with the plants? But, you know, botanists can be badass too, all right? I mean, just look at any of the old school guys, like David Fairchild or anybody. I mean, they're cool people and they do cool work. And I think that was my biggest thing to overcome, was that kind of stigma of like plants as being kind of boring, right? Because they're not. They're amazing. You know, they're amazing organisms that cover more of this planet than any other living thing.
Do you have any suggestions for research? Because it sounds like you've learned so much about all of these species that you collect. Like, do you have any suggestions for good places for people to expand their knowledge besides the Bloom and Grow Radio podcast?
Well, no, I mean, disclaimer, I'm not a botanist. I've never had any botanical training. I am just a collector. I am just a hobbyist that, you know, travels a lot and has done this kind of thing. I don't know what I want to consider myself even. I mean, I guess I'm just like a...
You're an enthusiast.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an enthusiast, but I'm like, you know, I'm like a level above an enthusiast.
Yeah,
like,
you're next level enthusiast.
I'm like a nut job, you know, but
yeah.
just to give anybody who wants to take it to the next level, just like a concept, you know, I've only been doing this for 5 or 6 years, you know, I haven't been doing it very long. And before that, I was coming into this with zero knowledge of plants.
You're a botanical bro.
Yeah, I guess. I'm a botanical hipster, I guess. I'm like, my plants are better than yours.
but where do you learn? Like, do you just take to the internet? Like, do you have books that you like?
It's all about networking. And that's where things like social media has been just like an absolute godsend, you know. As ridiculous as it is to say, I have a lot of friends that only do Instagram and refuse to do Facebook, Facebook is an incredible tool because right there at your fingertips, you got collectors and researchers from all over the world giving you amazing advice on how to grow stuff, on the taxonomy of stuff, just any question you have. I mean, when I first started, and it was so nice that, you know, even though I was a newbie, you know, all these people would take me seriously and take me under their wing and teach me stuff. And, you know, people like Enid O'Folter from NSE, you know, she's been like my mentor in so many ways.
She's the best.
She is the best. When I first met her, I was just like a total amateur. And she took me seriously and she was like, here, I'll teach you this and that and give you this and that. And I was like, whoa, you're awesome. Facebook allows me to do things like, you know, email Peter Boyce in Borneo or like, you know, or contact David Sherbarek at the Lyon Botanical Garden in France, you know, and talk to these world-class researchers in their respective fields about anything. And so it's a great tool that should not be kind of squandered. And through doing that, it's also allotted me the opportunity to go travel to not only different countries, but different botanical collections. You know, I've been behind the scenes at New York Botanical Garden, U.S. Botanical Garden, Huntington Botanical Garden, Mobot, Fairchild, just all over the place because I can network with these different researchers and collectors. And that's an excellent way to learn too, just by networking and talking to people.
My hashtag and community that I like to promote is plant friends in real life, meaning like if you make plant friends maybe on the internet, like take them off the internet into real life, like meet up in person or like get a DM going, like slide into the DMs, like get a Facebook message going, like make real friends in this plant community. And it's been really cool to see how that's manifested. And like, you're just the living example of plant friends in real life and like what you've been able to accomplish. And now you're my plant friend in real life, which I'm so excited about.
What you say there is actually important. And that's something to really take note of, people. You can network with people, do your best job of meeting them in person. Because the internet, you know, it's nice to have communications with people, but like without actually having that face-to-face interaction, you know, it's just, it doesn't compare, right? And you can't forge those kinds of relationships. So don't be afraid to go into the field with people or just like, you know, meet with people or you know, go to gardens together, whatever, right? Like take a chance on somebody.
I have an upcoming episode with Danae from Foley Collective on how to foster plant friendships and community. So stay tuned. And speaking of social media, where can we find you if people want to reach out to you or follow your accounts and all of your planty adventures? Where can we find you?
Yeah, well, you guys can follow me at Mick Mitty, which is my Instagram handle. And then I'm also on Facebook as Mick Mittermeier. And that's where you'll find me posting pretty much every day, all kinds of random ecological memes and you know, plant related photos and stuff. So I don't have a blog yet, but maybe I should.
It doesn't sound like you have a lot of free time, but in the little free time you have, maybe you should start a blog. Well, I'm so thankful you spent time sharing all of your knowledge and adventures with us today. And I can't wait to meet you in real life next time I'm in Miami.
Yeah, please. You're welcome to come stay with us for the Airway Show. You can come and I'll show you all the good collectors down here.
Oh, awesome. Well, thanks so much.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mick, for that wonderful conversation. His knowledge on all of these plants just blows my freaking mind. But I love that Mick is really the truest example of Plant Friends IRL, which if we remember, a year ago in February is when I launched that plant hashtag, Plant Friends IRL, when we did Friendship February last year on Bloom and Grow Radio. So in the spirit of Plant Friends IRL, if you feel moved to make a new plant friend this week, whether it's in a local plant shop or maybe it's online, over Instagram, over Facebook, reach out to someone, give them some advice, maybe ask for some advice. And if you do accept this challenge, tell me about it on today's episode's Instagram post on Bloom and Grow Radio. I want to hear your plant friendship stories. Also, Mick was kind enough to send me photos of almost all of the plants that we talked about in today's episode. I know that we were throwing a lot of plant Latin around. So if you're curious to hear what we were talking about, you can head to the show notes at bloomandgrowradio.com/Mick. That's M-I-C-K. And you can check out all of the amazing different plants that we talk about. Thank you again to Wally Grow for sponsoring this episode and this month on Bloom and Grow Radio. Billy and I are really in love with our green wall that we made with our 6 eco planters, and The thing I love about WallyGrow is that no two walls are the same when you install WallyGrow planters, because you can truly customize your space with whatever you want to do, whether it's adding a couple of ecos into a gallery wall like I've had some friends do, or whether it's making columns like me and Billy did, or you could do an entire lush wall of plants in your space. So if you're curious, head to WallyGrow.com, see all of the indoor and outdoor options that they have for you, and use code BLOOM20 at checkout for 20% off. Okay, plant friends, until next week, keep blooming and keep growing. Plant friends, thank you so much for tuning in today. If you like what you heard, make sure you are subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. And while you're making sure you're subscribed, why don't you head on over to the review section of whatever podcast player you're tuning into and leave us a review. I would greatly appreciate it. If you want to join the Bloom and Grow Garden Club, head over to bloomandgrowradio.com/garden-club to join the planty fun. When you join, you get a free download of the Keep Blooming print that Molly Mansfield made exclusively for us, and you will also get an email with the password to the private Facebook group, which is what I like to call the plantiest corner of the internet. It is pretty amazing. For behind-the-scenes scoop, plant tips I learn along the way, and sneak peeks of future episodes, follow me on Instagram at @bloomandgrowradio. And plant friends, I'm here for you, so drop me a line if you have an idea for an episode, live event, or maybe if you're a planty business looking to sponsor the show. I am always here to help you keep blooming and keep growing. Make new plant friends, propagate knowledge, and grow some freaking joy. That's the motto of the Growing Joy Garden Society app and platform, otherwise known as the plantiest and kindest corner of the internet. If you've been an OG listener or a longtime listener, you might also know this app and platform as the Bloom and Grow Garden Party, but with the rebrand, we've rebranded it to the Growing Joy Garden Society. No trolls allowed, kind plant friends only. And if you haven't heard about the Society yet, Plant Friend, you got to join. It's my online community that you can access via iOS or Android app or on your computer that I built to connect our international community of plant friends so we can all nerd out together about plants and celebrate our passion for our beloved plant babies. We have members literally all over the world. I'm so in love with this community of sweet plant friends. I can't say enough amazing things about them. But also, there's a lot of really cool features about the app you might be interested in. There's dedicated hashtags to all sorts of different subsects of planty passions like houseplants, gardening, plant-inspired DIY projects, growing joy, plants and pets, and so many more. There's a plantrepreneur group, so if you're a planty entrepreneur and you want to connect with other planty entrepreneurs, you can join that group to connect and network. There's a plant swap section. Plus, the entire app, and this is my favorite part, is entirely searchable. So say you want to learn more about Hoya, you type the word Hoya into the search bar, and literally every post ever created about Hoya will pop up, so you can click in, see what other people have been posting about Hoya, and learn on your own and crowdsource hair information. It's so cool. But last but not least, it's an amazing way to support the show. Your monthly membership not only goes to sustaining the platform, but it also supports my team of editors, writers, and a community manager that help the world of Bloom and Grow keep growing. So come join us. All you got to do is go to jointhegardensociety.com and sign up for the community plan. Once again, you go to jointhegardensociety.com and click the community plan. Hot take, plant friends. There is no one right starter plant. There, I said it. And you know what? While I'm at it, there are also no real plant killers in the world. There are just people who have not figured out their right plants for their lifestyle. This is why I created the free Plant Parent Personality Test, because plant friend, I want you to get thriving alongside your houseplants as quickly as possible. So I made this cutie little plant parent personality quiz that's totally free for you on my website to take the guesswork out of building your plant collection effortlessly and joyfully. After speaking to thousands of members in our community, I realized that there are about 5 key plant parent personalities, each one with their unique set of strengths, weaknesses, and a unique set of plants that thrive under their care. For example, a mindful plant parent, someone who wants to engage with their plants daily, use them in their morning routines. If someone gifted that plant parent a succulent and they watered it every day, that succulent would die immediately. However, that drought-resistant succulent is a perfect match for a low-key plant parent, which is someone who travels, has kids, is busy, doesn't have time to engage with their plants every day. They're looking to engage with their plants more like once a week or once every couple of weeks. In addition, obviously, to understanding your light and basic plant care that we provide on this podcast, Happy Plant Parenthood is all about discovering your personality and then picking the right houseplants to go with it. It's that simple. No more stressing over your collection. So what plant parent personality type are you, plant friend? All you got to do to find out is take my free quiz on my website and let me know. You can access it at growingjoywithmaria.com/personality. After taking the test, you'll get an email with a list of plants, podcast episodes, and planty projects that I think would light you specifically up like a full spectrum grow light. So once again, that's growingjoywithmaria.com/personality for your free plant parent personality test results.